Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. It is wonderful to speak with you this week. And I wanted to do a special shout out to the people, of course, in the United States and Canada, our regular listeners, and to people in Great Britain and Australia. And also, during this past week or two, our listeners in great numbers in Sweden and Norway. Always fascinating. Please be in touch. There are some people who have written to me describing why it is that they think in their country they are really listening to this show more. And I am going to be reading some of those responses on the show in the next few weeks so that anyone else who's curious about why we have listeners in certain parts of the world may get a bit of an answer, at least from that person's perspective. And for today, we have a returning guest, Sinane Shea. She is a nuclear engineer in South Carolina. Her childhood in white Christian nationalism normalized conspiracy theories like Obama's birtherism and the biblical apocalypse. But 2020 with COVID and QAnon finally made her realize something was deeply wrong. Now, Sinane is writing a book, Taking Off the Tinfoil Hat, How Lizard People and Space Lasers Dismantled My Christian Worldview. We invited Sinane back to the show to continue discussing the inseparable link between cults, conspiracy theories, and Christian nationalism. Here's Sinane now. It is so nice to be able to have you back, Sinane, because there's a lot that was covered and there's a lot still left to be covered. And I know sort of that's how life is. There's always more to talk about. But still, with this specific issue, it would be lovely to have the conversation go more towards why is it that people get so angry, defensive, protective of these beliefs, where it's like you're taking away a safety net of theirs, and they're kind of approaching you with almost that kind of panic, like the idea that, you know, scary people are scared people. And so I feel that vibe when we're dealing with these issues and when a family has brought me in to try to talk to someone to try to see if they can look at things in a more logical way. The resistance that I come up against is this one where, you know, I won't be safe if you take this away from me, which is an interesting thing. There's so many places for us to start. So maybe what we can do is have you just start with what helped you break free from it.
Sure. I think what you are saying is insightful and just true, because even if you could force someone into the process that I have gone through, what I call de-indoctrination, even if you could like force somebody into that, something that I've really been thinking about recently is like, I don't know how ethical or, you know, right that really is, because it is traumatic and it is difficult. And I think that a lot of times religion and high control groups and cults and like whatever you want to call it, people fall into these things for a reason. They do serve purposes, social and psychological needs. They do help people. It's not to say that, you know, these are 100% evil systems. They help people with, you know, like addiction or family problems or finding a community. And these are things that people really need. What I think it comes down to is that in a lot of cases, especially in like the toxic, controlling environments, it is kind of a band-aid on a wound that needs surgery. It's an oversimplification, and it doesn't actually address the underlying issues, but it does help on the surface. I would say that you really need to be empathetic and understanding in approaching people who are stuck in these beliefs, because they are fearful of losing it. They might not have the resources or the ability to find that stability after breaking the foundation that they've been standing on.
Yeah, right.
And what my point is in writing my book and in talking about this sort of thing is, if it's not causing harm, then, you know, whatever floats your boat. But white Christian nationalism is causing harm. And the conspiracy theories, which again, like, it always comes back to conspiracy theories for me, uh-huh. are the same as the beliefs that I grew up with. I began to see them as just, it's not just about like a belief, but again, a worldview. You view everything through this lens of this like pre-existing bias, and then they build on top of each other. So you have a whole network of ideas and beliefs that is much harder to come out of. And which is why it can be scary and harmful even to break somebody out of a network of these beliefs. And it wasn't until I was watching, I think it was like the first Republican primary for this coming election, and Vivek Ramaswamy, who hopefully history completely forgets about, he was one of the presidential candidates on the Republican Party. He gave a little speech and was talking about the endemic of single mothers.
Oh, no.
And how our country needs to turn back to family values, rattling off all of the favorite conservative talking points. And it was when he said that, specifically the endemic of single mothers, that something clicked for me as it just being like an alternative explanation. And again, it's just a lie, but even the people who are sharing this, they don't know that it's a lie. It's very convincing and it seems plausible if you don't know any better, which is why like totalistic ideologies hinge on ignorance and why you see white Christian nationalism attacking education, because it's a lot easier to say that, oh, all of the problems in our country are caused by not having like the nuclear family and an endemic of single mothers and, you know, women wearing mini skirts, instead of like, if you actually, some great books would be Poverty by America by Matthew Desmond. He also wrote Evicted, where he talks about how most single mothers who go on to welfare, public services, are off within 2 or 3 years. They don't want you to know that people living below a certain poverty line actually end up spending a much higher percentage of their income on housing, because the system has been so corrupted that landlords in certain systems are allowed to charge more. And you could end up paying as much or very, very minimally less in a very undesirable neighborhood than you would pay in a very desirable neighborhood. Like, the cost is almost the same. And that effect on poverty and generational wealth and the effects of mass incarceration and how you would get like 10 times the sentence for crack than you would for cocaine, even though the drug is essentially the same exact drug. And, you know, the history of the war on drugs started by Reagan and then worsened by Clinton. So it's these alternative narratives and explanations for like, here's a problem. This is my explanation for this problem. They're so effective at tricking people that it's been picked up by both sides. The left and the right have really pushed this tough on crime narrative when we know that these are not the things that actually make crime go away, that effectively using social services and rehabilitating people, there are other countries that have completely eradicated their like prison systems almost because they have so well dealt with the issues of crime and poverty. And we're still pretending like we don't know what the solution is.
Yeah, right. I think, you know, also just to say about that, that, you know, we go into this punitive mode way too quickly when really so much can be prevented by a community coming together, by someone noticing that someone's having a hard time, someone offering a resource, offering a shoulder. My son is a social worker, had learned about a lot about conflict resolution and how to talk to people. So in a non-punitive way, he works with homeless population. And I always will remember this. And I feel like so many people are really needing this piece and don't get it. There was a person at where he's working who was going into people's drawers and going into cabinets and offices, and she was getting yelled at a lot. Get out of that. This isn't your stuff. Why are you, whatever, do we need to call the police? So my son decided to go up to her and say, is there something I can help you with? And she wasn't expecting that. She already kind of leapt backwards thinking she was going to get yelled at. And she said, actually, no. But she kept staring at him. And he said, do you just want to have a conversation? And she said, yeah, I don't know how to get people's attention unless I'm doing something wrong. And I need you to know I'm here. It was this moment of getting to the heart of it. But instead, you know, she would have been kicked out or the police would have been called or she would have been blamed for stealing things. But she was just trying to find a way to say hello. And growing up, the way that you got attention was negative attention. So there's so many people who just need a moment to tell their story, to just say, this is actually what's true for me, which is really very interesting. Same thing, I think, with a lot of people who get involved in conspiratorial thinking. They're coming from a place of anxiety, coming from a place of distrust, coming from a place, and it's well-founded a lot of the time. And could there be an opportunity before they get full-blown into building underground bunkers? You know, can they get into just being asked, like, is everything all right? And do you need some help feeling safer in this world? You know?
Yeah, that, and this is something that is like well and far outside of my wheelhouse, but I've also heard some therapists and counselors and other podcast guests talking about like adverse childhood experiences and how that affects people's development and how, you know, they learn to get attention and how it affects their ability to perform in school. And then that affects their ability to find jobs and how we so fundamentally don't understand just like basic human psychology and how that plays into all of these social ills that we want to blame on the endemic of single mothers. And I feel like there's a reason that they do this because the cults and the conspiracy theories and white evangelical nationalism, it provides an alternative explanation. And often it is an oversimplified explanation that feeds into your own bias and into your own prejudices to your benefit. And so one of them would be psychology. Like I was taught basically growing up that, you know, if you have like a mental health issue, that is a moral failing and that you don't have enough faith and that you need to turn to God and to turn to Jesus. At most, you could get biblical counseling from your pastor or something, but to go to a secular therapist was taboo. And I think that part of the reason that they do this is because on some level, someone knows that using proper mental health resources might actually fix some of the issues and provide explanations for behaviors and things that like white evangelical nationalism wants to claim they have the only answer and solution for. And if you find help somewhere else, then that combats their claim. And the same thing goes for evolution. We all know that the, you know, evangelicals hate evolution. Like this, it's like Harry Potter. You can't even say the word. And it was in The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. I was never really taught evolution. And I have an engineering degree. So people think that like, oh, she knows science and stuff. But like my degree is mostly like math and like physics. Like I didn't do a lot of biology. I don't have a background in that sort of thing. And I never had the opportunity to. And it was in The God Delusion where I feel like I really had the first introduction to like evolution and also like the implications of evolution. Because if we evolved with some of our characteristics, some of the fallacies, the logical and psychological fallacies that we're prone to that make us prone to conspiracy theories, we have those because we evolved with them, then that explains human behavior in a way outside of original sin or fallen nature evangelical doctrine. They don't want us to learn that because they want to tell us that they have the one true only explanation for why we are the way we are and how to fix it. And another important point, especially for me in my experience, was that people see that I have a degree in engineering and they're like, oh, she must have critically thought her way out of her beliefs, you know, like, oh, she learned about evolution and, or, you know, whatever it is. And that really didn't happen. I honestly feel like it was like two separate parts of my brain that they did not overlap. It does help with critical thinking, like learning how to learn and education. Like it definitely did help with critical thinking, but it didn't shake my beliefs at all. What I think that it did do is it provided me with self-confidence, self-esteem, you know, self-reliance. I learned that I could learn and that I could rely on myself. And again, they don't want you to know that. They want you to think that you are dependent on the group or the doctrine or whatever it is. And there's a whole thing, you know, tying back into like purity culture and stuff. In my personal experience, I could not until recently, with a lot of hindsight, kind of articulate what had happened. I just kind of felt it. But when I first started dating my husband, my now husband, he was my first boyfriend. He was a Catholic. My family obviously was very upset about this because they think that Catholics are not real Christians and that they're all going to hell. And then also because my family did not pick my husband. You know, it wasn't like a courting situation. I was post undergrad at this point. I'm like in my 20s. And because of just purity culture, because of whatever family dysfunction we have and like the control that they seem to feel like they needed, I was harassed for this. My mom told me that I was going to have to stand before Jesus on judgment day for dating him, like implying that I was going to go to hell for dating him. She implied that, and I don't really have any other way to say this, but, you know, she implied that he and his friends were going to gang rape me and that he was probably cheating on me. And like, how do you know he's not cheating on you? Like every time we went anywhere, you know, she was talking about this sort of stuff. This was my first boyfriend. I'm coming out of purity culture where I am unprepared to date, to have adult relationships, to have any of that. And the other thing is, and this is, again, all very, you know, specific to my scenario, my roommate in college, we lived together all 4 years. I'd known her since kindergarten. We went to the same private Christian school in elementary and middle school. We're very, very close. She was also raised in the same white Christian nationalist environment that I was. She had been planning to save herself for marriage. She was waiting for God's chosen husband for her. And she dated a man, and I want to say around our senior year. And she slept with him, which was a big no-no for us, obviously. But she thought that he was her husband. She thought that like they were going to get married. He had said that they were going to get engaged. We found out right before I graduated that he had a homosexual sugar daddy that he was living with in Miami and that he had been cheating on her with a slew of other random people, just anybody who he could pick up, and that he had lied about his entire life and that he didn't have a job that he said that he had. He didn't have the degree that he said that he had. The car that he was driving was bought by the sugar daddy. And I'd only been with my husband, not my boyfriend at the time, for like maybe a month when all of this broke. And I'm unprepared to date or to, I'm very naive. And, you know, I had to ask him, I was like, do you have a sugar daddy? And and he said no. And I was like, well, that's exactly what you would say. And then my mom is telling me that I'm going to go to hell for dating him. And I'm having to navigate all of this on my own. And instead of my parents taking the time to get to know him and taking the time to like help me vet if this is a good person for me or not, I was attacked and I had to figure everything out on my own. So my education taught me that I could rely on myself. And then some of the abuses of the totalistic beliefs of purity culture and everything else taught me that I had to rely on myself.
Wow. Okay. It's an incredible thing just to say here that when you know something about yourself, it can be very calming, very motivational and relieving. And then you are actually able more often to do the thing that you have told yourself you can do because you've kept your brain in a calm state so that you can focus, you can think, you can have judgment, you can have good memory. And having that kind of confidence is a really good thing. Like with whenever I taught my kids to drive, they chose me because I was the more relaxed parent, but still inside, not so much, but outside, you got this, because I knew as soon as I said, oh, you're so good. And if I noticed something real, like, oh, you really managed that corner really well, suddenly they were better drivers because they had this sense they could do it and that I trusted them. And then they didn't have to feel worried. And then they weren't having this rush of adrenaline, which makes everything harder. But I think also when you're talking about needing to forge your own life here with being in a relationship, having a friend also who was really taking advantage by someone who is not at all honest. I mean, whether, you know, he can have his life with his sugar daddy, but he needs to not lie to your friend, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that what you're talking about too with your mom's reaction is how much people are guided, acculturated to not trust, you know, that you somehow can't trust your boyfriend at the time, that he and his friends are going to be up to something and something horrific. And that the only way then to keep yourself safe would be to be dating someone else or dating someone within the church, I suppose. And it shows the black and white dichotomy that it's either something safe or something wildly horrible and nothing in between.
Yeah. And my family did eventually, I mean, it took years. And at this point, it's basically just like too little too late. But they did eventually come around to my husband. And I wasn't there. But apparently, like right before we got married, my mom had a conversation with my husband that he told me about after the fact and said, like it was a totally normal and like good thing for her to say that that she had really hoped and prayed and like begged Jesus to come back like for the rapture before I was old enough to start dating. But she guesses that, you know, he's the next best option. So this was really kind of meant as like a compliment. But when he told me this, this was right before we got married. So right before I had really gone through the real deconstruction, like imminently beforehand, I don't think that, you know, my family or my mother would have ever like hurt me. And I know that it's not exactly the same, but it felt like, oh my God, that's like a Jonestown mother. She wanted me to die a virgin. She believed so deeply in this that she would have rather I died a virgin than for me to have gotten to experience life. And it's such a juxtaposition too, because growing up, me and all of my friends, like we talked about this, we were like 13, 14 years old into high school and stuff, would pray that Jesus wouldn't come back until we'd had our first kiss. Or the really like scandalous girls would like pray that it was until after they'd been married so that they could have sex. I didn't go that far. I just wanted a kiss. And you know, so we're just like praying that we get to like have some life, and our moms are praying the complete opposite.
Right.
And it felt perverse, and I could not shake the comparison to mothers in more destructive cults who had physically harmed their children for the sake of their beliefs. And I know that that's kind of a harsh comparison, but I couldn't shake it.
Yeah, no, of course. It's a startling comment. What did your husband think about it?
Oh my goodness. he was not raised in evangelicalism, and he also was just like never exposed to it. So he had kind of gotten the picture in like the years of us dating, but he just kind of told me about it, and he thinks that the way that I was raised is basically crazy, like his words. So
yeah, pretty intense for him.
Yeah. He didn't experience it. So
mm-hmm. Right. Okay. But in those conversations with your mom, not that it sounds like there were so many of them, but what you hope to is that he has more of a sense of you, what your childhood was like, what your life is like, what you're up against, you know, your conditioning, And I think it does help to kind of open a door into your history, your psyche, and your challenges with all of this. You know, when it is that severe of a message, my goodness.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. But to kind of go back to a little bit of what we were talking about before, you know, what broke me out of indoctrination, like what led me to live a different, you know, in a different direction. Education did play like a huge role. As I said, not because I learned about evolution or whatever, but because it gave me self-confidence. And the other thing that I think that it did that, again, I haven't really been able to articulate until very recently is I really love Janja Lalich and Margaret Singer's definition of like a cult, or the language that they use calling it social and psychological control programs, because it is social and psychological. And the social element, what going to school did for me was, and for the first couple of years, I think we talked about this in the last episode, I didn't take full advantage of being in undergrad, like meeting new friends and like joining a bunch of clubs and stuff, because it's too, like you're taught that everybody is trying to influence you with satanic worldly influence, and that you need to convert people, and like you can't just have friends, you know, like you have to try to save their souls or whatever. But eventually my schooling, so my whole social circle for the first like 2 years of undergrad, it was me and my roommate. We found a church to go to, and that was our network. It was kind of a Pentecostal church. And then the last 2 years of undergrad, my degree got very strenuous. And so I didn't really have time for that anymore. I spent most of my time at school, and I really finally connected with people at the university in the nuclear engineering program. And it's a small program, as you might imagine. And I belonged and I fit in, and I had friends in a way that I feel like I had not really ever done before outside of a church setting. And you know, we were still obviously very different people with very different backgrounds, but we weren't just like, you know, people going to church who might have like rather conflicting personalities and stuff, but like you have to be friends anyway because you're sisters in Christ, and you can see things get really catty in like, you know, youth groups and women's studies and things. But like we actually had things in common. Like we were frankly trauma bonded going through undergrad together. Yeah. And, you know, I belonged because of my accomplishments and because of, you know, more than anything that just being in like a church setting had ever been. And then when I graduated and I came to work where I work now, I contract for the Navy. And so again, I'm kind of in a very unique social setting where, again, I more or less fit in. And I think that why white evangelical nationalism, the hyper-patriarchy groups like IBLP, why they are so counter education and also counter women working outside of the home is because I learned that you can have that sense of community and friendships and meaningful connections outside of the church setting. And again, they tell you flat out, like explicitly, they just tell you that you can't have those things outside of our group. If you do have friends outside of the church, then they're not really truly meaningful friendships. You know, you can only have that sort of thing based on Christ. You know, in finding other places that I belonged, you find that that is a lie. And it they start to have less of that social control over you. But if you lived your entire life in a bubble and you don't know anything else, you really don't know that you could have those connections anywhere else. And so it's extremely scary to try to branch out or walk away. So like the critical thinking is helpful, but really the self-confidence, and then, you know, hopefully finding other meaningful communities outside of, you know, whatever your belief system is, were really the things that I think greased the wheels, so to say, you know, because again, that was years before I actually deconstructed, but it makes it less scary when you do finally see the lies for what they are. And
right. And I think also when you mentioned before about people really not having something else, like this is their life. And they're very busy, I think, buying into this idea that it's superior, it's the only, it's the best, and that that's the focus rather than sort of what you're giving up by being there and what you could have if you left. And if this is the only and the best, then, you know, the kind of the equation in your mind can be there is nothing out there for you and nothing that will make you feel as special or as protected or holy or whatever else. When you start to have these experiences where you can achieve things, where you can be seen in a particular way, appreciated for your intelligence, engage in interesting conversations, you realize that you can actually make a connection to the world. And you can also be appreciated for not just what you believe, but who you are and what you can do and what you think. And that also are, it's like this other modes of connective tissue to the rest of the world and also to building confidence. It's really incredible that you were able to have these experiences. So you were going to say.
The alternative explanations of the world, of how the world works, the lies, basically. I really have just like latched on to this like one historical fact that really shook me when I learned about this, that in Mussolini's Italy, there was a period of time. Mussolini was like the first fascist, kind of invented it almost. And there was a period of time where Mussolini attempted to ban pasta in Italy. Doesn't sound like a good idea, right? went over like a lead balloon.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And the reason for this was because he was like a hyper-nationalist fascist dictatorship. And he wanted Italy to be entirely self-sufficient, like their economy to be like a nationalist economy and not to be reliant on imports and like trade agreements and things. And so all of the flour, apparently, that the Italians were making their pasta out of was being imported from, I want to say, like Turkey. So he wanted to push them to a rice-based diet because somewhere in like the north of Italy, they could farm a lot of rice. And when he did this, he didn't say, oh, we want to have a national-based economy. He said pasta is making men soft and is damaging the nuclear family. Like, if we want women to be women and men to be masculine men, like, it was a masculinity crisis that pasta was causing. And they published a bunch of, like, state propaganda cookbooks that had, like, rice-based dishes and things in them. So there are these photos of Italian anti-fascist freedom fighters posing in fields with sheets of pasta as an emblem of defiance. So, I mean, next time you eat spaghetti, like, or you can tell yourself that it's for anti-fascist reasons. And so when knowing that and then watching Vivek Ramaswamy say that we have an endemic of single mothers, I was like, oh my God, that's our pasta.
Uh-huh, right.
Claiming we have a masculinity crisis because of pasta. All of the problems of Italy are hinged on pasta. This is no less ridiculous for us to say that, like, our family values moral panic of, like, we need men to be men. There's a masculinity crisis. You know, we've strayed from our Judeo-Christian roots and we need to have more Christians is just, it's a false explanation. And it's just as ridiculous as Mussolini's spaghetti.
Wow, I love that. It's like gay marriage destroying,
yes.
I don't know, right? I mean, marriage is marriage. So, but there's no such thing as gay marriage. I thought that was strange.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right.
And it's the same thing as conspiracy theories. Like, technically, like a conspiracy theory, if you want to call it that, should be a conspiracy. Like, somebody is like conspiring to do something. And, you know, so like, you know, misinformation isn't necessarily always a conspiracy theory, but we kind of use the terms interchangeably. But like, the homosexual agenda is a conspiracy theory. The attack of radical feminists is a conspiracy theory. And it's all centered around this like family values, moral panic. All of the world's ills are these family values, moral panics. And it's an alternative explanation for what is actually caused by like generational wealth disparity, racism, discrimination, and misogyny.
Oh my goodness, yes. Yeah.
And this is another thing. This is another one of the things that I've just like latched onto and the hill that I will die on is that James Dobson, I have unfortunately read several of his books
okay.
as part of research for my book. And in his Bringing Up Boys, which was published, I want to say like around 2000, like in the 2000s.
Uh-oh. I'm bracing myself for what
please
you're going
to do. Uh-huh. Like trigger warning. Uh-huh. He, for those who don't know, James Dobson runs the Focus on the Family empire. He's extremely influential. He had over like 8 million weekly listeners to his like Christian family values radio shows. And one of the things that was in Jesus and John Wayne that again, like really shook me is to learn that James Dobson developed a family ethics course for the United States Army. And I forget what it was actually called, but all 785,000 active duty United States Army members were forced to go through a James Dobson training program. So you can imagine a level of influence that this man has on our culture and our society. And when I was raised, my sexual education, or lack thereof, the only thing that I got was my mom forced me to listen to a James Dobson audiobook, where basically he told me that our sexuality is tied directly to our spirituality, and that if you commit a sexual sin, you are irreparably damaging your soul. So this man had incredible power in politics as well, and cultural relevance. And in one of his absolute best-selling books, I think it's called Bringing Up Boys, there is a quote, and I wish I had it written down, but he literally says that like, oh, because of the specialization of their brains, boys are better at math and science and logic and reasoning. And this is why you see more male physical scientists and architects and doctors and et cetera.
Oh, that's why.
That's why. Not because women literally couldn't even have bank accounts until the 1970s and were like barred from public universities and like, you know, the actual history of things, but because their brains are better. And again, as a woman in STEM, this is like particularly insane, you know, so it's a false explanation. They're offering an explanation, but it's spaghetti.
Right. It's false correlation. Absolutely. Yeah. Attribution error.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many things to call it. It's so interesting because it's sort of like putting the cart before the horse. Like, okay, so now that women are not going into this, let's explain it away in some other way, as opposed to giving them an equal opportunity. Oh, look at that. Wouldn't that be interesting to see what would happen? Or not just marrying them off, you know, right after high school and having them go into becoming wives and mothers and actually being able to pursue a career. It is so disheartening and it's frightening how many people buy these books, how many people listen to them, how many people read them and are swayed by them and believe them, I think still to this day.
Mm-hmm.
My goodness.
I think that it also really ties into really what is the kind of the core narrative of evangelicalism and white Christian nationalism. I mean, obviously, I think that it really hinges on biblical inerrancy and American exceptionalism, but another really big facet of this ideology is individualism, like Lockean 1600s philosophy. Individualism really is kind of in the bedrock of American philosophy. Like the founding fathers who wrote the, you know, Declaration of Independence and things were influenced by Locke, and how deeply that ties into like prosperity gospel and then dominionism. Because one of the books that I read early in my deconstruction that like was very impactful was Divided by Faith by Michael Emerson. He's a sociologist, and he was looking at why is there a white church and a black church? Like, why is like the evangelical church divided by race the way that it is? Not necessarily from the historical perspective, because obviously racism, segregation, and books like The Color of Compromise go into really good detail about some of the history behind that. But from the sociological perspective, like what are the differences today in like what white evangelicals believe versus what black evangelicals believe? And he found really shocking statistics that asked why there were racial issues in the United States. Like one, white evangelicals overwhelmingly denied that there were any racial issues. And then two, like, but asked if like, you know, like why, you know, he would give them some specifics, like why are there more like black people in this field or that field or white people, vice versa. Overwhelmingly, compared to all white people, white evangelicals, even more so, clung to this idea of personal responsibility and individual action in order to fix any kind of like racial issues that do exist. We just need to be nicer to our neighbors and we need to like have a Black friend. Whereas like all people who were asked this question, like white evangelicals were worse than just like regular white people. And then asking Black evangelicals kind of this the same question, you saw the same split, but in the opposite direction. Black evangelicals were even more likely than non-evangelical Black people to say that the problems are systemic and that it is based on discrimination and kind of a history of racism and, you know, issues with the justice system and the housing systems and the welfare systems and all this stuff. Again, The Color of Compromise does a really good job of like talking about how we've basically been on the wrong side of history at every point. The major denominations, the Baptists, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, split due to slavery, due to segregation. There were, of course, people fighting for abolition and fighting for integration in every demographic. But, you know, statistically, white evangelical churches were on the wrong side. I think that that comes down a lot to absolute ends justify any means, specifically for slavery and segregation. That's because of biblical inerrancy and biblical literalism and a very like destructive and evil interpretation of the Bible to say that like Black people were the descendants of Ham and that they were accursed by God to be slaves. Like that is nothing more than like lunacy and conspiracy theories. But ultimately, absolute ends justify any means. And if you have this absolute end of hell and saving souls, success looks like big churches. Success looks like having butts in seats. And if you want to appeal to the most number of people, you can't challenge the status quo. And so, one, that kind of allows you to not fight, you know, for major social justice issues because you want to be appealing to the lowest common denominator. And then there are these quotes from Martin Luther King Jr. I think it was in his I Have a Dream speech. He talks about, I have a dream to one day see children of every race holding hands playing in the street, right? And there's a rival quote from, I want to say, Billy Graham himself, where after that speech, he says, we will never see little Black and white children holding hands and playing in the street in this life. We will just have to wait until Jesus comes back for that to be accomplished.
Wow.
Yeah. And even though, you know, evangelicals love to try to paint Billy Graham as some great, like, advocate for racial justice and that he had integrated services and stuff, and he did where it was socially acceptable, and then he segregated in other places. But that's the mentality of like, oh, well, we will never see that in this life. We can't shake the boat in this life because we need to save souls. It ties into that individualist element because, and this is very, you know, the traditional like pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of mentality is the same as prosperity gospel, is that I am wealthy and I am successful because I've been blessed by God, because I'm righteous, so God has blessed me. And so if you are poor and you are struggling, then at least on some subconscious level, evangelicals will think, well, maybe they deserve that. Maybe they have some sort of moral failing and God is either punishing them or God is using this as an opportunity for them in some way. That's how you end up with partially Trump, because they're like, well, look at how rich he is. Look at how successful he is. He must, you know, he has integrity. He must have, mm-hmm. you know, worked his way to that point. So they're further incentivized to deny any kind of like privilege that we have,
right?
You know, racially or for Christian privilege or for any other privilege. The thing that I find supremely hypocritical is looking at the core salvation narrative at this point, because evangelicals can be so callous against people going to hell. One, because I don't think that they can fully grasp what eternity means. The human mind just like does not fully grasp eternity. But two, because they think that, oh, I chose salvation and you didn't choose salvation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they say there's this contradiction that people have pointed out of like, oh, how can Christians say I'm so blessed and God has given me everything that I have. I'm so blessed. At the same time as saying that I've worked for everything that I have, like, you know, bootstrap mentality. And honestly, they are kind of saying the same thing because they saved themselves by choosing salvation, by choosing righteousness. So it's much easier for them to callously say that, like, oh, you chose damnation, you deserve hell. The only solution to all of the problems of the world is once everybody's a Christian, you know, we won't have any more crime once everybody's a Christian. We won't have any more poverty once everybody's a Christian. So we don't need to attack like the social justice issues or discrimination or, you know, mass incarceration or all of these other problems. We don't need to work against like poverty and, you know, the social network programs. We just need to convert more people and that will solve all of our problems. The magic solution, and they have the one and only solution.
So interesting. I know we're about done with time. I think what's also what you find a lot are these justifications for things, reasons given that are so contradictory. Like you have this prosperity principle as you're talking about, and that people will be rewarded for doing things the right way, for devoting themselves to something, for giving over money, and that God will shine on them and, you know, and their life will be good. And then you also have all the people who have really nothing, who they're also trying to get to stay connected to the church. And sometimes they might say that it's because they're sinners that they have nothing, or I hear more often that they are suffering like Jesus did. They are more spiritual. They're bringing them closer by having them like send their last check that they got, their welfare check. They're bringing them to this place of suffering like Jesus did. And so that's helping them become more holy, more spiritual, and they will then reap the benefit from that. So in any direction, whatever I think works for the church, if it's a fraudulent place, will be the explanation about why you just deserve what you have or don't deserve or should have so little, should have so much. But either way, there's some way to explain it away.
To tie it back to conspiracy theories and QAnon, I think that, I mean, there's so much wrong with this. And there's obviously like so much danger in all of this. But like one of the things that was like kind of another connection for me is like we talked in the last episode a little bit about Pastel QAnon and the summer of 2020 and the child sex trafficking moral panic that took over. I don't think that we got into it, but the Sound of Freedom movie in the last like year or so, there was a huge blockbuster movie that came out from Tim Ballard, who is he's a Mormon. And he used to work for some like government agency, and then he left that government agency to basically start a vigilante group that would travel to like third world, quote unquote, nations to save child sex trafficking victims. But it was very sketchy, and he was taking people who were not qualified in any way to do this. I'm not to say that they never did; they never helped anybody, but they were. Some cases like going into areas that did not have like a trafficking problem. And then in an attempt to catch traffickers, they would ask for children and then people would then go and find children. So they were creating a demand for trafficking in places that didn't necessarily have a demand beforehand. And then were not in any way following up with the care of the children after their like sting operations. And it was in July of 2023, a movie was released, like a true life story about Tim Ballard, and this Operation Underground Railroad was his organization. And the guy who played Tim Ballard was Jim Caviezel. And Jim Caviezel was a hard-pilled QAnon talking about adrenochrome, going to QAnon conferences and things. So they were deeply like inculcated in conspiracy theory circles and things. The Pastel QAnon summer of 2020 Save the Children moral panic, of course, really jumped on to the Sound of Freedom movie, you know, movement. And then it came out in the months following the movie's release that Tim Ballard was let go of his own organization because he had been involved in some sexual harassment slash assault accusations for women who worked in his program. And at least one of the people who had financed the movie was involved in a, you know, sex with a minor incident. The whole thing was just riddled with just, you know, every accusation is a confession kind of thing. And after this, actual experts really stepped forward and were trying to explain to the Christian and Mormon mommy bloggers who were like drooling over this film why it was dangerous. And I talked to multiple people about this personally in my own life. Overwhelmingly, they would just say, well, oh, maybe Tim Ballard has problems, but overall, isn't it good that we're bringing attention to this issue? I have from one attorney and former fellow at the Department of Justice Anti-Trafficking Task Force, they had some really good quotes in response to this. They were saying, when you have a case of really subtle coercion that's hard to prove and the jury is expecting taken, you're not going to get a conviction. And that makes it much harder for the survivors. The movie and these conspiracy theories are grounded in this sensational perspective of what child trafficking would be and not a realistic portrayal, because often it looks a lot more kind of like a one-on-one, what you might call like a pimping situation.
Right.
And like coercive persuasion. And it creates a false perception. And it creates harm when certain policies aren't passed because we think trafficking looks one way, but it is actually another. And the same thing, I think, applies to any of these false explanations, mm-hmm. alternative mm-hmm. explanations. We think that an issue and a cause for this issue looks one way. And so we're going to address our like corrective policies and just our public opinion of these things in one way. But if that is not realistic, if it actually looks differently, our corrective actions are not going to fix anything. So for trafficking, you really need substance abuse programs and, you know, government funding, education, and not a wall on the border necessarily. You need to teach about coercive persuasion and manipulative, you know, comes back to cult psychology,
right? Influence, all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And instead, again, you just get like a wall on the border. And it's the same thing for, you know, the family values moral panic. We think that the problem looks one way and it's caused by one thing, and we're not actually going to fix anything.
You know, I go back to this expression I didn't understand when I was young, but that there's nothing new under the sun. And that, you know, you see that time and time again, even though players might be different, the ideas might be a little different, but the drives, the needs, the fact that people also, they have a selective vision, selective memory, they have their blinders on when needed to support their own needs, really, their own issues. And so it becomes frustrating for the educators out there to get the word out, knowing that there are some people who are going to be very resistant to hearing something that's factual because it doesn't support what they're needing emotionally, but still it's worth a shot. So that's why I'm so happy that we talked again. And I think there's hours more of talking we could do and educating that you could do. And so I really do appreciate the time, appreciate all that you've done, all that you've read, and how you're able to synthesize it. And I'm so happy also that your life is on this trajectory now where you get to see what you are truly capable of and also be able to kind of enter into a world where it is about learning, it's about synthesizing, it's about growing, it's not about superiority. It doesn't have to be that someone is the best or the worst. You can just be and you can grow and learn, and how nice that is without all the competition. So, pleasure to talk to you again.
Yeah, thank you so much.
One more thing before you go. It is always so good to talk to Sinane. And to be able to learn from her, to be able to have a sense that there are people out there who have so much information, so much to share with us, and are more than willing to do it and are happy to do it and enjoy doing it. I love her enthusiasm about talking about these subjects. What is also important is to be able to deal with the fact that we have so many people now who are taking on a certain idea about religion because they really do feel like this is the way the country is supposed to be, this is the way the world is supposed to be, this is the way everyone should be. And when we look at our country here in the United States and how it was founded on the separation of church and state and freedom of religion, it is the actual and absolute opposite of the tenets of the kind of ideas that were presented as necessities so that what we were trying to get free from and escape from doesn't repeat itself in our own country. But here we are. Here we are where there has been this slow growth and slow burn of this Christian nationalism, of this, I think, completely entitled rewriting of history, that somehow this is what's best for our country and somehow this is what our founding fathers really meant and really wanted. I mean, this is not the first time things like this have happened where people have decided what Jesus said. People have decided what God says all day long, every day. And people have been able to get back into historical figures and kind of say, well, we know what they really meant. I can't imagine ever saying something like that. I don't think you can either, where you would have the hubris, the lack of humility to be able to say that. But when we talk about this idea of Christian nationalism, specifically white Christian nationalism, then we have this notion that works for so many people because they're fed it for this reason that I think, and this I realize is my bias, looking at it psychologically, but that I think really delves into the issue of anxiety. As we've talked about on this show, the messages that get so drummed into people are usually the messages that get enforced with or laced with or woven in with fears. What would happen to us if we didn't believe this way? What would happen to people if they didn't have somehow a God to follow, the God we've decided they need to follow? What would that look like? Well, we don't know what that would look like if they believe different ways. We do know, because we're raised in this environment or because we've seen visions of it, we do know what our country would look like if they all believed the quote-unquote right way. Then we wouldn't have to worry. We wouldn't have to worry about difference. We wouldn't have to worry about people having their own rights. We wouldn't have to worry about women deciding that they had a right to make decisions about their own body and what would happen then. We wouldn't have to worry that people who are gay and lesbian, trans, would have rights and be able to live out their life freely because, well, that changes the order of things. It changes it from being ordered, from being all set, from being basically Stepford. And that makes some people nervous, very nervous. But I would rather people deal with their anxiety over difference, deal with the anxiety over change, then make sure that everyone is the same so that they don't have to actually address and feel their own discomfort and their own anxiety around it. When Sinane talks about how she was able to break indoctrination and also why some people hold on to it, it's very much tied in, I think, with fear. And again, I think people who are conspiratorial thinkers are fear-based. I think people by and large, not all, but by and large, who are fundamentalist in their thinking about everything, including religion, tend to be more fear-based. I think, though, it's also getting into the worry about falling below. And what I mean by that is that I think one of the reasons that people hold on to this kind of what I see as indoctrinated thinking, and that's also how Sinane talked about it, is that what goes along with white Christian nationalism is American exceptionalism. And she talks about how it led to American exceptionalism. You can then feel superior. And that is what some people need to feel. Also, I think, led by insecurity, i.e. anxiety. People get worried about being less than, being beneath, being below. And unless they are above, they're sure they're going to be below. People who are not concerned, people who are not driven by fear, don't worry about where their place is a lot of the time, if they're above, if they're below. They get busy just having their day, doing their thing, but not figuring out where their place is and if they have somehow lost their standing. And so I think when we deal with people who are holding on to indoctrinated thinking, but are really pushing an agenda, we want to get behind it. We want to be able to understand what is behind it, why it is that they need to enforce something in us in order to feel more relaxed in their own bodies and to feel superior in their own hearts and minds. It is important to know where it comes from so that you don't listen to the message that somehow you need to be different. You're able, when you hear people being superior in this way, I think, to kind of boomerang it back to them and think, what is it about them that pushes them to need for me to change, for me to believe something so they can feel relaxed and assured, so they can also feel special? I don't want the rest of the world to have to change to cater to the ego needs and the emotional needs of a few. The problem is the few are growing into the many. And so we need to keep our eye on this. We need to understand where it's coming from, but we also need to know how to respond. And that is why there are a lot of shows on this podcast that we're doing, a lot of episodes about this subject. So you feel educated about it and you understand it and you know how to respond to it, even internally. So you don't feel like you have to absorb the message and change who you are and change what you believe and change who you accept and change who you hate and change who you feel needs to be changed. I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.